myth is invention about reality, which is born out of the fact that we are made in the image of God, who is himself imaginative and an inventor.
I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. All About Jack is celebrating its 10th anniversary in 2021. And sometimes over the years, I've done a special mini-series on a topic or book that I believe deserved highlighting. Such is the case today, as a spotlight shines on the 2018 release, The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. The author is Dr. Charlie Starr, and he is on the show today. Plus, I have a co-host for this series, Dr. Sarah Waters. We'll hear from both of them shortly. Before we do that, let me briefly explain a few things. This mini-series is a total of 6 episodes, so this is the first of them, meaning 5 more will follow. Also, while I previously did a single show covering the entire book, you still might want to check that program out, which you can do by following the link in the show notes. One of the reasons to check out that old show is because today's program is an overview of only the first half of the book. Then the second and third episode will cover the first 2 sections of The Fawn's Bookshelf in detail. So you will have to wait until the fourth show to get an overview of the other half of Charlie's book. This means the last 2 programs will go into greater detail of those third and fourth sections. That final show will also give a quick summary of the first half of the book. Well, with that out of the way, let me welcome my co-host, Dr. Sarah Waters. Welcome back to All About Jack.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And then our guest is Dr. Charlie Starr, who is no stranger to the podcast. Welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thanks, William. I'm always happy to be here with you, my friend.
All right. Well, then, so we are exploring The Fawn's Bookshelf, subtitled C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. And my co-host, Sarah, we're going to go back and forth with the questions. We're going to let Sarah start us off.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to ask $1 million question. You mentioned the Fawn's Bookshelf. Which books are on the Fawn's Bookshelf? And how do they fit with why you wrote the book?
Well, that's a great question. The 4 books appear in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lucy is looking at Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf while he is off making them a tea. And there are many books, but only 4 titles appear. And those 4 titles are The Life and Letters of Silenus, Nymphs and Their Ways, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend, and Is Man a Myth? And those 4 titles then were the impetus for doing a study on Lewis's theory of myth for me. So, you know, people have been talking about Lewis's theory of myth for years. Myth was incredibly important to Lewis. But when I thought about it, no one had yet to write an entire book on Lewis's theory of myth. And there's certainly enough material out there to do so. In my book, I didn't even cover it all. So it just seemed like a book on myth needed to go out. And the 4 mythical books, mythical, not just in the sense that they are about myths, but that they are, that they don't exist. In the modern sense of mythology, Lewis never actually wrote those books. I thought they were a perfect avenue for approaching Lewis's total theory of myth. And I really think in hindsight that that was a really good choice. I wondered if this quirky approach to studying Lewis's theory of myth was really valuable, really valid. And I think in the end it is, because part of what myth does is it embodies. And so to use an embodied approach to talk about myth rather than some sort of very abstract yet straightforward analytical approach helps suggest something of what myth actually is. And I know we'll get into that as we go through the series.
Yes, in fact, we're going to be touching on aspects of that right now. And, you know, even though, as I noted in the introduction, I had done a standalone interview with you about the book, which did cover overall. We mixed up we adjusted the questions, went with different ones, as well as that interview, which people would still check out in the show notes to listen to. Since we were at Taylor University at the time, we did some unique things there with some other people involved, or at least one other person. But yeah, one of the things that we sort of asked there, but we also want to get on the table here because it's very foundational to understanding your book and then what you're presenting. And that is, you know, why should we care so much about myths? After all, aren't myths just lies or fiction at their best?
C.S. Lewis, of course, once believed that that was so, that myths were just lies, though breathed through silver, he once said in a famous conversation with Tolkien. Early in his life, Lewis believed that myths were just invention, and that they had no connection to reality, to history, and therefore they had no connection to truth. They were imaginative constructs meant for the imagination to enjoy, but the imagination for Lewis was not a source of truth for the young Lewis. For the later Lewis, there's still a great deal to debate on regarding the connections between imagination and truth in Lewis's thinking. We want to say that there is a definite connection, but Lewis's writing seems to suggest that maybe there's not. When somebody asks me the question, did Lewis believe in imaginative truth? I want to answer yes and no. And I think that's about as close as we can get to coming to a final answer to that particular question. But for Lewis, then, myth really mattered because in that famous conversation with Tolkien, what Lewis learned was that myth is not mere lie. Myth is invention about reality. So it's imaginative invention, which is born out of the fact that we are made in the image of God, who is himself imaginative and an inventor. So God is the creator. And on a lower scale, then, we can be creators. Tolkien famously referred to us as sub-creators in his poem Mythopoeia, which was written about his conversation with Lewis on that one fateful night in September 1931, right? And in their conversation, what Tolkien taught Lewis was that myth has truth value because it is invention about reality. And then Christ is the story of all mythic stories. It's the mythic story that actually then happened in history. And so C.S. Lewis would refer to Christ as the myth become fact. But in addition then to the most important thing, and which leading to Lewis's conversion to Christianity, what's also important then is that myth became valuable for Lewis as a source of knowledge. And later on, he will talk about this in a lot of places, but especially famously in his essay, Myth Became Fact. Other places as well, even in Mere Christianity, certainly in his book, Miracles, and so on. For Lewis, myth is a way of encountering the real, which leads to knowledge. And I use that vocabulary very specifically. We would tend to want to say, for Lewis, myth led to truth. And I don't think we'd be inaccurate saying that. It's just that Lewis had a very specific definition of truth. And so he wouldn't particularly put it that way, but he would say myth helps us encounter the transcendent real. If we wanted to start talking Plato and Platonic essences, that's what myth sort of helps us capture. And in myth, we can take truth, which for Lewis is otherwise abstract ideas that we have about reality. In myth, we can encounter truth as reality, apart from its abstraction. So that's really, really important for Lewis. And that then is important for us as Christians today, or as anyone who's interested in the study of anything from the fairy tale to the science fiction story. In stories that feature the fantastic, whether we call them sci-fi or fantasy or the like, in story or even magical realism, if you think about it, in stories that feature the fantastic, we encounter some level of the real that realistic literature, modernist literature, can't, or at least doesn't, tend to capture. So myth is a way, a mode of knowing. That's a nice way that I like to put it. Myth is a mode of knowing. And Lewis did not at first believe that, but by the time he was into his 30s, he did. And you see evidence of that even as early as The Pilgrim's Regress when he tried to write his personal biography as an allegory. So yeah, myth is really important. I would go so far as to say that myth is a mode of thought that is ancient and that we were in danger of losing in the 20th century. This traces all the way back to the Enlightenment, where certain modes of thought were considered no longer significant. First, reason was the most important mode of thought, and then science became the most important mode of thought, even to a sense over reason, so that at one point, even reason itself in the form of philosophy was having what's a good term for it? A bit of not an identity crisis, but a bit of a self-esteem crisis, if you will, where science seemed to be the dominant way of thinking about everything. And as proof, and I talk about this in the book, as proof of this, I like to think of two examples where, again, in a 20th century that was dominated by the modernist project, and then the postmodern project, which in a certain sense is just an extension of modernism, and modernism an extension of realism. In the midst of the movies the people were making, the writing that was being done, the literature that was being produced, the poetry, the stage drama that was being produced, by the time we got to the 70s, there was like this gigantic vacuum, culturally speaking, in the West, where mythic thought had been utterly lost. And two people then in the 20th century, probably more than two, but two stand out to me, deliberately wrote myth as a curative. That is, they invented myth. Now myth in human history tends to be a thing that coalesces rather than is invented in any kind of deliberate way. But with the study of myth that was going on in the 19th and 20th century, and therefore looking at myth at a more conscious level, again, two people in my mind stood out. One was J.R.R. Tolkien. This isn't to say that Lewis didn't participate in the same role that Tolkien did, but Tolkien seemed to deliberately want to write myth for his nation. And root them in myth again. So there's that. And then especially in the world of film, where in the 1970s, the kind of movie making was the kind of movie making done by Scorsese and Coppola. And the 70s were the decade of Woody Allen. And it was cynical, it was self-aware, and it was very, very adult. But somehow in the middle of that really, for me, depressing decade, disco, just come on, really. Somehow for me, in the middle of that decade, comes this guy named George Lucas, who deliberately wanted to write a myth in film version, and he did in the form of Star Wars, which changed then the direction of film ever since, and has helped, fantasy and science fiction find their place in contemporary culture. So there was such a strong need for mythic wonder in the latter half of the 20th century. Well, and even in the middle of the century, there was such a need for mythic wonder that somebody had to deliberately start writing myth again. And Lewis did that. Tolkien did that. Lucas did that. And the reason I mentioned Tolkien and Lucas then is that it was argued very effectively by Tom Shippey that while the literary critics of the 20th century would all point to the modernist literature, and they would name something like James Joyce's Ulysses as the most important book of the 20th century. The people, and not just ordinary people, but people who were readers, pointed to Tolkien's book, to The Lord of the Rings, as the most important book of the 20th century. And so he deliberately brought myth back for more people than maybe even C.S. Lewis did, though certainly Lewis had his contribution. And then certainly in my mind, George Lucas changed the way Hollywood made movies and then the content of film coming out of Hollywood as well. William, you're right. You might remember the 70s when Disney almost disappeared, when Disney films were just not great. Nobody wanted to see them anymore, or if they were great, people still didn't want to see them anymore. The G-rated film disappeared in the 70s, and Disney put out their first PG-rated film. Can you believe that? In the form of that, what was it, The Black Hole. And Disney didn't figure out how to make a movie again until 1990 with The Little Mermaid. And it was primarily because they started studying myth, as you'll find in Christopher Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey. It really was a true study of myth, following Joseph Campbell in sort of the secular mythic or secular approach to studying myth. Following Campbell, then Vogler realized, well, these are the kinds of stories that people want to hear. And of course, Lucas proved that by writing the Star Wars stories according to Joseph Campbell's, Hero of a Thousand Faces, the hero's journey. So yeah, myth is absolutely necessary. It won't go away. And the fact that we are currently in a glut of films about spandex wearing gods, superheroes, is proof. We may get tired of superhero movies, but we'll just find something else. Some other wondrous thing that we absolutely have to put into film, and we'll keep on doing that.
So thinking a bit more in detail now about the content of the book itself, kind of moving away from myth in general and thinking more specifically how you apply it, I guess. I was just wondering if you could give maybe a brief overview of the parts that you want to draw readers' attention to from Folios and Fauns, which is part one, and Narnian Reality, Terran Myth, which is part two, which are the next two sections that we're going to be covering on the next two podcasts.
Yeah, that's terrific. So part one then is the first three chapters of The Making of Many Fake Books, which is terrific. Fauns and Their Fantasies, and then Might Myth Be Real, chapters one, two, and three. So the first chapter is probably the funnest chapter in the entire book. I think there's a lot of great chapters, but just for pure pleasure, chapter one is terrific as I go through many, but I didn't catch them all, but many examples of when Lewis would write fake books. He would either just create the titles for fake books, or else he would quote from fake books, that sort of thing. And this is something they did on a regular basis. And again, I think it's fun. I think it's wonderful. Probably the most famous example is when he wrote a critique of an early example of, or an early version of Tolkien's Beren and Lúthien. And Lewis wrote the critique as if the Beren and Lúthien text were a true ancient text, and scholars were speaking. And then there's another great one where he wrote a letter to Barfield in which he critiqued some Barfield work from the 50s, but Lewis was writing that letter in the 1930s. But various scholars were talking about Barfield and how Barfield had said to Lewis, "He taught me everything I know about language," which is hilarious because the reverse is the actual truth. So that's just a fun chapter. And then that chapter leads to talking about the concept of mythopoeia, of writing on the sub-creative level in a way that creates new realities, that invents sub-created realities. Then the second chapter on Fauns and Their Fantasies looks over, since the book is about the Fauns bookshelf, I thought we probably should look at this one mythic image as it runs throughout C.S. Lewis. So chapter two then looks at what Lewis thought about Fauns. What does it mean that they are sylvan creatures? What do they symbolize? Why they're important to this particular story? Fauns are seductive, and so there's a sense in which Tumnus at first is acting like a fawn toward Lucy, not in any inappropriate way, but in the worst possible way in terms of wanting to kidnap her and take her to the witch. But then he rejects that and thinks better of it. There's also this peculiarity about fawns in that they get intermixed with satyrs in the various tales. And that is something that Lewis particularly liked to talk about in myth, the weaving in and out of the flowing in and out of mythic development, which he then applies to his gods in Till We Have Faces. So we deal with that in that chapter. And then when we get to chapter three, we're talking about Might Myth Be Real? So Every probably third or fourth chapter, I leave off talking about the books on the bookshelves. And I say, now let's do some book theory. Let's do some myth theory. So chapter three then is the first chapter to take up the question, is myth a reality? In what way is myth real? So again, for early Lewis, that was not something he believed. But for later Lewis, there are reasons to think that myth might have some connection to higher reality, not just in terms of heavenly reality, but in terms of a society of mind, a web of mind, which suggests that people are connected more supernaturally and more completely in thought than we can imagine. So you hear stories about a mom who is convinced that her daughter is in trouble, so she picks up the phone, and it turns out that's the case. Or how about this one? Here's one that really annoys me. You ever have a really good idea, only to find out 6 months later somebody has already marketed it and made millions of dollars on it, but you came up with the idea utterly independently and on your own? So that sort of idea, that idea that Zeitgeist idea of an interweb of minds, interconnectivity of minds, even here on Earth, even before we enter any kind of heavenly realm, and that's picked up then in this particular chapter in terms of ideas of myth. One of the great examples being when Lewis talks about the story of forms of things unknown, where astronauts who keep going to the moon disappear. And we learn that it's because on the moon, what is myth here on Earth, the form of the Medusa actually lives on the moon. So that's kind of interesting. What is the connection between myth and reality? Chapter three just begins to explore that. Well, then in part two, Narnian reality, Terran myth, the first thing that I noticed in just looking at the four books on Tumnus's bookshelf, two of the books are about what on Earth would be reality, but in Narnia would be a myth. And two of the books are about the opposite. In Narnia, it's reality. They just take it for granted, like the existence of fauns. On Earth, it's a myth. We don't imagine that. So part two are the two books that deal with Narnian reality and Terran myth, and those are The Life and Letters of Silenus and Nymphs and Their Ways, which I just love those titles. So chapter four then picks up The Life and Letters of Silenus, and we learn something about who old Silenus is. And the first thing I always say to people about that is, go to Disney's Fantasia, and in one of the last sequences, there's a Greek myth sequence. And in that sequence, you'll find a rather portly old fella in a toga who's clearly inebriated, and he's riding on a donkey. And that is Silenus. All right. So that's old Silenus, the drinking companion of Bacchus. And so then we talk about why would Lewis include Silenus in Narnia? What's he there for? The chapter talks about a couple of things, but I'll just say it's very much about the celebration of life. Lewis believed in good pleasures because good pleasures could take us to God. Chapter five, fauns are from Mars, nymphs are from Venus.
Now, chapter five there, that's a very creative title there. Someone should come up with, someone did come up with a regular one, but how did you feel at liberty to go ahead and title it the way you did?
Yeah, imitation is the truest form of flattery, right?
Yeah, something like that.
And of course, it echoes the book, which takes up the issue of gender differences between men and women. So I thought it was time in this chapter to turn and talk about what Lewis had to say about men and women. Why would you do that in a study of myth, or even in a study of nymphs and their ways? And what triggered it for me was the fact that fauns don't have a female counterpart who are also fauns. There are no faunettes. And nymphs don't always have male counterparts who are in some way human or anything like that. Often, nymphs are associated with fauns. So fauns tend to be male. I think they're always male. And nymphs are female. And often, these two groups get together. Well, this is an interspecies kind of thing going on, right? And then I realized, it's like men and women. They're these two totally different species from each other, right? So I thought I would go ahead and talk about what Lewis had to say about women, women and men in that chapter. And that was really a great deal of fun. And then chapter 6 picks up why Sylvan myths matter. So chapter 6 then really is about the two titles. Both Silenus and nymphs are Sylvan characters, demigods. Lewis really loved nature. I take up two things that matter to Lewis. One is the encroachment of progress upon nature. So nature gets destroyed so that we can put in roads and build factories. And that made him very miserable. He wrote in one letter talking about that, literally the words or the letters grr, G-R-R-R. So he's very, very unhappy about it. The other, though, is Lewis's rejection of any kind of reductionistic approach to nature where nature is turned into a machine, nature including man. He refused to say, to watch the world continue to be stripped of its meaning. Something he talked a great deal about in That Hideous Strength, for example. And in The Empty Universe, a little introduction he wrote to a book that I'm now blanking on the title of. But yeah, so there's parts 1 and 2 of Fong's bookshelf.
Yes, thanks for that. So, well, now, before talking more about your book, give us beyond the myth of who Charlie Starr is. Who is this man?
Born in Texas, raised there, moved to Appalachia and fell in love and never wanted to leave again. I taught high school for a few years. I have been a college professor for 24, 25 years. I've been teaching for over 30 years now. I teach composition, literature, some film, and I've had some fun making some movies with students throughout the years. Write articles and books when I can, especially on C.S. Lewis, and I've done some fun pop culture things too. The Fawns Bookshelf was my 7th book, and my 2nd book about C.S. Lewis. So I've also written some books that do some Bible study, a couple of fiction, science fiction novels, a children's fantasy. So I like to write, even though I don't really make any money or much doing it, but I nevertheless enjoy writing and just feels like a calling and a passion. So I continue to do it. Go to church, sometimes get to preach in church. My bachelor's degree is actually in religion. And so sometimes I'll preach in a tiny country Appalachian church. And those are always such fun. And I was in an old building from the 1800s just a few weeks ago. Married to my first wife and the only one for 36 years, love my Becky very much. We have 2 grown children. One's a videographer, one's a photographer. I'm especially pleased that they pursue God with their hearts, and they're just fun. I really enjoy one of the funnest things about growing older after you've tried to meet some of your goals, or some of your goals maybe didn't get met as much as you would have liked to have seen them, is the delight in children who you've raised as well as you could and who seem to have their lives together and are doing wonderfully well. So my kids in tough times are a real joy to me, and they're just a ton of fun, right? Little kids are fun at times, and teenagers you can deal with, but adult kids are just a lot of fun, and then they eventually will get around to giving you a granddaughter, and who knows how many more might come along. So I do get to enjoy time with my granddaughter, and that's I guess I should talk a little bit about me as a C.S. Lewis person. So I did mention the two books. I've written some articles on Lewis. Big fan of studying Lewis and myth. Big fan of studying Lewis's epistemology. And the next book will perhaps deal with that somewhat. And the current book, Fawn's Bookshelf, deals with that as well. And then my funnest thing to do is, while working on my first C.S. Lewis book, and rather by accident, I started focusing on Lewis's handwriting because I realized his handwriting changed throughout his lifetime, and that if that could be mapped out, we could date undated Lewis manuscripts by the changes in his handwriting. And that has led to some wonderful discoveries, including Lewis's earliest analysis of myth, as well as the lost archangel letter, Lewis's singular attempt to write a sequel to the Screwtape Letters from the point of view of an angel, and a number of other just really wonderful manuscripts. So that's probably the funnest thing I get to do in the Lewis world, and I get to meet all kinds of wonderful people that way, and get to work as a colleague, get to collaborate with these folks all over the world. So I have many international friends now who I still haven't met in person, but I've been delighted to meet through email or on Zoom. Sarah Waters and I have been working on a project that she's working on in terms of Lewis's Shakespeare annotations, which I'm giddy anytime she sends me some manuscript images to look at and say, oh yeah, this is when he wrote that. And so we have a great deal of fun. That's the funnest thing I do in Lewis studies. So just wonderful. And every now and then I get to be on a wonderful podcast, including the very first caster of pods that I ever got to work with, William O'Flaherty. And we've been having a good time now for a solid decade.
Indeed we have, Charlie. Well, at this point, I usually have my guests summarize things at the end, but because this is part of a series, I want to do a preview of the next episode instead. Even though you talked about the first of the four sections in your book earlier, because it will be the focus of the next show, and we've talked about a lot of things, let's close this program by having you remind us what we will be diving deeper into for episode two.
All right, well, part one consists of the first three chapters. The first one then is on the making of many fake books. And it seems to me that the reason the book titles matter is because of this mythopoeic quality that makes them make us believe the world is larger than the world we're just seeing in the stories. So there is a larger world going on here. And these four book titles tell us that that world exists, but all we get is the titles. If we open the books, they might be able to teach us something about the nature of myth. And that is, in fact, then why I wrote the book in that particular way. Let's explore these books. And of course, the only way we can open them is by our own invention, since Lewis only gives us the titles to work with. Well, I truly do believe then that for chapter two, what is most significant about Fawn's is this idea of celebration, of right pleasure. And I think of Screwtape when Screwtape tells Wormwood, tempt your man with the easiest pleasures possible. Don't give him any real pleasures, but you do want to tempt him. Now, wicked pleasures work. Screwtape's not a big fan of them, but wicked pleasures work. But if you can just get the man to, instead of reading a good book, read some advertisement in a newspaper, the slow road to hell is just as effective as the steep one, right? So for Lewis, right pleasure points to God. So long as we don't turn those pleasures into our God, we're in good shape. Those pleasures are in their right place. Then comes the idea that myth might be real. And one of the places Lewis sees this, which he talks about in Miracles, is in the form of the god Bacchus. as we look into how myth might be real. At Cana, when Jesus turns water into wine, the veil is lifted, and the appearance, the false god who nevertheless carries some element of truth in him, the god Bacchus, is shown as he really is. And it's the true god who turns water into wine all the time by making grapes and then turning, you know, taking them through natural processes, as well as human ones. So for Lewis, myth is a pointer to the real, and even false gods have elements of truth meant to point even the pagans to the one myth that was also a fact. And Bacchus is a really great symbol of that in terms, again, of right pleasures, but also in terms of the image of the god turning water into wine.
Well, Charlie, thank you for that preview of how we're going to go more in depth into the first three chapters, which is the first part of your book. The book, of course, is entitled The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters, part one entitled Folios and Fawn. So we look forward to that in the second episode in this mini series, a total of six shows. And so part two is next with the first part of your book. Let's go ahead, though, and before I thank everyone for being here, let's have Sarah share a little bit about herself, some of the studies and interests that she has, and what she's currently doing.
Okay, thank you very much. So I live in Oxford in England, and I work on C.S. Lewis, and I'm particularly interested in his writings and thinkings on Shakespeare and how that impacts his wider canon. So I'm working on a couple of book projects which explore that, partly on Narnia and then partly more thinking about Lewis as a reader and as an engager through Shakespeare and what he's doing with that. I'm also an honorary junior research fellow at the University of Buckingham, where I also lecture, and I also lecture at Oxford Brookes University as well.
Oh, great. Well, excellent. And then we'll have some more things about Sarah, as well as a project that we're working on. We'll touch on that in a future podcast. But again, we've been doing a look at of the Fawn's Bookshelf with Dr. Charlie Starr, this first episode. Thanks, Charlie, for being on All About Jack.
Glad to be here, William. This was a lot of fun.
And then let me also then thank my co-host, Dr. Sarah Waters. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
I also want to thank you, the listener, for your interest in this episode of All About Jack. All About Jack is a feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm the creator of the show, William O'Flaherty. Please consider visiting EssentialCSLewis.com to check out a variety of content I have there. It includes, of course, previous episodes of All About Jack, but another popular part of the site is a series of articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard the first in a series of six programs from a mini-series about the Fawn's Bookshelf. Episode 4 will provide an overview of the second half of the book, while the next two shows will go deeper into the first and second part of Charlie's book. You'll find links in the show notes to purchase the book, along with links to other places that were mentioned during the show. I'll also provide direct links to other episodes when Charlie was a guest. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis, Most are not by him. Some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.